Chapter 68. The Oder Plebiscite. News of the Polish invasion and violation of the plebiscite terms provoked an unforeseen reaction in Germany. Thousands of veterans and young patriots improvised military units and rushed to the rescue of their beleaguered Silesian compatriots. They managed to put the invaders to flight. Paris and Warsaw were stunned by this German audacity. The Polish politicians decided to bide their time until February 11, 1920, when the Allied troops would finally reach Silesia. Theoretically, the troops were under the authority of an international commission, but in reality it was more in the nature of a French expedition. Wilson had declined to send a single American soldier because he could not afford to lose the Polish vote at home. The British sent 4 battalions with instructions to avoid confrontations, and the Italians sent a token force of 2,000 men. Clemenceau, however, sent 11,000 soldiers. Furthermore, the Allied forces would be under the command of French General Lauban, who would be to Silesia what Mangin had been to the Rhineland, except that in this case Lauban would have Clemenceau's full backing. Lauban had been instructed to close his eyes to Polish infractions and provocations. The treaty stipulated that the plebiscite take place within weeks of June 1919, when it had been enacted. Yet months and months dragged on without the slightest action. The Italians were thoroughly bored. They understood neither French nor German, and even less about the issues involved. They kept wondering what on earth they were doing under grey skies 800 miles from sunny Italy. Polish agitators had a free run of the zone. They were paid by Warsaw politicians with French taxpayers' money. After 23 months of deliberate delay, the plebiscite was finally held on March 21, 1921. While the Germans had not been allowed to campaign for their cause, the Poles had been given every assistance to woo or intimidate, as the case might be, the local voters. The Silesians were promised escape from the hardship of war reparations if they opted to join Poland. Despite all threats and entreaties, the Silesians voted by a margin of 60% to remain German. The people had spoken, but the governments of Paris and Warsaw were not about to give up. Thanks to Clemenceau's addendum to the treaty, the results of the vote will be determined by the communes. Lauban ordered that Polish workers who worked in German factories be given the industrial zone of Silesia. These were guest workers who had been given the vote to offset German numbers. It was unlikely that Lauban would have acted without precise instructions from Clemenceau in this flagrant bid to negate the vote of the majority of Silesians, as well as ignoring the terms of the treaty. Yet Lauban went on to plan the sharing of Silesia, just as if there had not been any referendum. For their part, the Poles ominously threatened to back the partition plan with force of arms, if necessary. On May 1, 1920, the Inter-Allied Commission declared that partition, according to the voting results, was imminent. For the third time, armed Polish units invaded Silesia to enforce Warsaw's claim to the German province, regardless of voting results. While the Commission was waffling with words, Lauban allowed the invading Poles to do as they pleased. It was repugnant for him, Lauban, to take coercive measures against the Polish allies of France, for whom most of his officers felt a marked sympathy, said Benoist Mechin. Clemenceau would go even further. He would intervene on the side of the Polish invaders. On May 9, 1920, he instructed his ambassador in Berlin to present an amazing note to the German government: any dispatch of German troops to Upper Silesia will be considered a violation of the Treaty of Versailles, and France will respond to it by occupying the Ruhr. Benoist Mechin, L'Armée Allemande, Volume 2, page 185. Clemenceau's ultimatum shocked Germany. If action were not taken to protect a German province, which had just voted to remain German in an Allied-supervised plebiscite, then Germany would see the last of its industrial regions fall into the hands of the French army. The Polish government, strengthened by Clemenceau's intervention, organized a full-scale invasion of Silesia. There was an abundance of arms in Warsaw, accumulated by General Weygand during the Vistula campaign. The Polish troops had at their disposal large quantities of heavy artillery, hand grenades, flame throwers, mines, cannons, and an unlimited number of rifles. The invasion turned to terror. Germans were tortured, mutilated, and killed. Villages and castles were looted and set afire. Eastern Frontier of Germany, page 79. These lines were printed not in Germany, but in England. The leader of this wave of terror was a former miner turned journalist called Adalbert Korfanty. Officially, the Polish government claimed to have no control over the spontaneous explosion of popular will in Silesia, but the London Times filed a report from on-the-spot correspondence, dated May 10, 1921, which contradicted the Polish claim. The headquarters for the organization of supplies and assistance from Poland is maintained at Sosnowiec. There is a fact which is difficult to ignore: the border between Poland and Upper Silesia is as open as the London Bridge. Korfanty, who had initially been named plebiscite commissar, had become on the eve of the invasion insurgent leader. With full logistic backup, Polish troops poured into Silesia and took most of the undefended large industrial centers. They then proceeded to occupy both sides of the Oder River. The German government vainly appealed to all the powers of civilization, of reason and universal conscience, to defend its invaded territory. The conscience of politicians and governments is highly selective and proved to be so on this occasion. The international force headed by Lobon and the Inter-Allied Commission had heard and seen no evil, like the proverbial monkeys. Lord Robert Cecil remarked, "Since the start of the insurrection, the Inter-Allied Commission has lost all control over Upper Silesia." The question of Upper Silesia, page 6. Amazingly, only the Italians would live up to their obligations and with great courage would fight those who violated the treaty and the plebiscite they had been entrusted to protect. They alone would honor the mandate their British and French colleagues were ignoring, wrote Benoist Mechin. The Inter-Allied Commission began to declare a state of siege in the major cities of Silesia, proclaiming it would stop at nothing to restore order. But that is as far as it went. While the Italians were trying to stop the insurgents by force of arms at the cost of 40 dead and some 200 wounded, the French troops, which represented the bulk of the occupation forces, did not lift a rifle. Instead, they let through columns of trucks and artillery units. L'Armée Allemande, Benoist Mechin, Volume 2, page 180. The German High Command, faced with an imminent Ruhr invasion from France, did not react to the Silesian outrage. Once more help came from volunteers across Germany. Without government support, they came by the thousands with whatever weapons they could lay their hands on and once more managed to reconquer two-thirds of Silesia. In the words of Ernst von Salomon, Germans had answered the call of patriotism. "We did not care about figures, statistics, notes, ultimatums, hereditary claims and election results. There, the Silesians, appeal had hit us in the heart. It had overcome all hesitation and reflection. This land was German, it was threatened, and we went there ready to shed our blood to save it." Lobon, a fat little bureaucrat, was no match for the selfless and motivated German volunteers. They pushed back the invaders on three fronts. Their most heroic feat would be the recapture of the Annaberg. Bavarian volunteers fought 15 hours in hand-to-hand combat after hoisting cannons 4,000 feet high on rugged mountain terrain. The exploit was reported by an unknown soldier in a brochure called Oberland in Oberschlesien. "The bravest of men felt anguish and joy when they saw the black, white and red flag appear at the summit. It was the first victory since the ignominious days of November, 1918. The Polish formations had been dislodged. The volunteers recaptured 28 German villages. The Allies, who had closed their eyes on Polish atrocities, were now outraged that the Germans were defending themselves. They demanded that the German government enact a decree disbanding the volunteer units. Ebert signed the decree, fearful and broken-hearted. The Poles had been saved from total disaster, but the sacrifice of the German volunteers had not been in vain. No one would attempt to steal Western Upper Silesia, which Germany was allowed to keep according to the plebiscite. The scandal of the Polish invasion had strained relations among the Allies. The Italians, who had lost soldiers fighting alone, were infuriated at the British, who had done nothing, and at the French, who had sided with the Poles. Even an English delegate to the Inter-Allied Commission declared at Kreuzberg on May 13, 1921, Like most of the English officers in Upper Silesia, I feel ashamed and humiliated because I am well aware that the Inter-Allied Commission has failed in its obligation to ensure respect for the law and maintain order in this province. Lloyd George, who was responsible for this failure, went on record to deplore the Silesian tragedy with a copious amount of crocodile tears in what was really an attack against his French rivals. Either the Allied forces restore order, or the German troops must be authorized to do it. To prevent German participation in restoring order is not fair. Fair play has always been the principle which has inspired Great Britain, and I propose that we adhere to it until the end. Whatever the outcome, we will not bow to a fait accompli. House of Commons speech made on May 13, 1921. The Silesian tragedy had at least served a worthwhile purpose. It had brought to the world proof of the venality and hypocrisy of the Paris Peace Conference and the Versailles Treaty. Behind the pompous oratory were the base intrigues of greedy and mediocre men. Behind the lofty principles of the 14 points were men involved in sordid little electoral manipulations and conscienceless political deals, the stuff of democracies in every latitude. When Europe was crying out for magnanimity, generosity, and vision, the petty gnomes of Versailles answered with stupidity, hatred, and hypocrisy. It was therefore fitting that the Allies would dump the fiasco they had created in Silesia into the lap of the League of Nations. The League members had no wish to spend their time on such an unglamorous issue, so the Silesian case was passed on to a subcommission composed of one Spaniard, one Brazilian, one Chinese, and one Belgian. None of these men was very knowledgeable in Silesian affairs, but somehow they came up with a compromise which pleased neither Germans nor Poles. Germany would retain 2/3 of Upper Silesia while the Poles would be given 1/3. After Silesia, the Allies decided they had had enough with plebiscites. Despite intrigues and manipulations, they almost invariably went against them. The Silesian mess had furthermore brought universal discredit to the process. The last plebiscite on the agenda was in Schleswig-Holstein, on the German-Danish border. There the referendum took place without incident because the Allies kept well away. Even the Polish politicians had become sufficiently wary of unpredictable plebiscites to let the Czechs have 3/4 of disputed territories as well as part of the city of Teschen, which was thereby cut in half. Only in September 1938 would Poland regain the other half, taking advantage of the confusion caused by post-Munich developments. Thus a new Poland had been created. More than 10 million foreigners had been included for reasons of greed, vengeance, and stupidity. The Galicians, Ukrainians, Russians, Lithuanians, Czechs, and Germans would never be assimilated. They had been forced into a nation they hated, against their will. In September 1939, they showed what they thought of their Polish status. They rejoiced at Poland's collapse. Next on the Allied agenda was the forced herding of millions of Sudeten Germans, Slovaks, Ruthenians, and Hungarians into another Allied concoction, Czechoslovakia.